whether it's a constituent, whether it's a staffer, whether it's the media, we just need to make sure that we have the best policies in place to protect our employees.
State lawmakers consider revising the legislature's sexual harassment policy. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 20th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, 1 year after President Trump was elected, some Alaskans are cheering a big shift on development in Washington.
I think mining's going to take off. I think there's going to be new exploration up on the slope. I know oil prices are going to rebound to a certain degree.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance but think you can't afford it? Alaska's health insurance premiums are going down for 2018. If you need insurance or currently have insurance through the individual market, be sure to shop at healthcare.gov between November 1st and December 15th to confirm that you have the plan that best meets your family's budget and coverage needs. For local assistance, call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
The Alaska Legislative Council is scheduled to discuss forming a sexual harassment policy working group tomorrow. Lawmakers are considering how to revise the legislature's sexual harassment policy to ensure that harassment reports are handled appropriately. Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Keto III is the council's chairman. He says lawmakers need to make sure they're protecting victims of harassment.
There are some questions about how and when to report, and also questions about what kinds of training might need to occur with legislators and staff in order to make sure everybody's aware of the policy that exists.
Recent concerns about sexual harassment both outside Alaska and in Juneau have led lawmakers to consider making changes to the policy. The legislature's sexual harassment policy was last updated in January 2000. It spells out what harassment is and how people should report it. The policy also says that all reports will be investigated, and employees who violate the policy will be subject to disciplinary action. Anchorage Republican Representative Charisse Millette is a member of the council. She says a sexual harassment policy working group could become a permanent subcommittee that would review the policy every year.
Is there underreporting? Is there overreporting? Is there any reporting? And how does that work? And how do we make sure that employees and folks in this building, whether it's a constituent, whether it's a staffer, whether it's the media, we just need to make sure that we have the best policies in place to protect our employees.
Anchorage Democratic Representative Harriet Drummond is an alternate council member who will be filling in tomorrow. She says one challenge for reporting on lawmakers is the limited means of reprimanding them. Each chamber can censure or expel its members. Otherwise, it's up to voters to weigh allegations. But Drummond says the working group could benefit the legislature.
We have to provide a lot more clarity throughout this policy. And also, you know, just in looking at all of these personnel policies in general, it needs some good close scrutiny.
Before the policy was added to the council agenda, some lawmakers said they wanted policy changes to be in place by early next legislative session in January. When Donald Trump was elected president, Alaskans immediately started wondering what changes were in store, especially when it came to oil and mining. 1 year later, we have a better idea. The Trump administration is moving to get rid of many Obama-era policies affecting everything from Pebble Mine to offshore oil drilling to opening up ANWR. Last week, Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk attended two very different gatherings in Anchorage to hear how Alaskans are feeling about the big shift in Washington.
As Governor Bill Walker took the stage at an annual resource industry conference in Anchorage last week, he was practically walking on air.
Well, good morning. What a great day this is. It started off wonderfully in Washington, D.C.
Walker was feeling celebratory because that morning, Congress took another step towards allowing drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, just one of many pro-oil developments happening under the Trump administration. And Walker says the push is coming from the very top.
We have an administration that wants energy dominance, and I love it when President Trump has said a number of times to me, America cannot have energy dominance without Alaska at full potential.
At this year's Resource Development Council conference, the optimism was in the hallways, too, where there was a general feeling that a door that was once closed has opened up again. Clint Winsenberg was working at a booth for Alaska Industrial Hardware. He also thinks Alaska's future is looking up under the Trump administration.
I think mining's going to take off. I think there's going to be new exploration up on the slope. I know oil prices are going to rebound to a certain degree. So I see good things, positive things.
There's more potential and more opportunity than there ever has been.
That's Kate Blair, who works for the oil refining company Andeavor. But Blair does see one reason to be concerned about all the actions Trump is taking. She thinks if this administration moves too aggressively in the industry's favor, it could backfire at the ballot box.
What's scary is how many restrictions are being rolled back that it could, in fact, the pendulum could swing the other way, which is a little scary, that at the next election, people might feel like he has gone too far.
Blair summed up her feelings about what the Trump administration means for her industry in two words: cautious optimism. The conference ended with a focus on the optimism part, as participants cheered and clinked champagne glasses. But the mood couldn't have been more different at a gathering organized by a local left-leaning group. It was held at the Willowall restaurant, less than a block away from the industry conference.
The dread and fear that we all felt last November, for me, has really found a place to roost.
Valerie Brown of Trustees for Alaska choked up as she spoke about the Trump administration's policies. Trustees for Alaska is a law firm that often represents environmental groups.
I know some of us here were thinking maybe he would not act as badly as his campaign rhetoric promised. And those of us who dared to hope for the best now, I think, have all the information we need to join the ranks of those who feared for the worst.
The Pebble Mine, the potential for drilling in the Arctic Refuge, the rollback of environmental regulations, everything people were feeling excited about at the Resource Development Council conference, here it was cause for sadness and alarm.
I'm not hopeful at all.
Dana Durham of Girdwood was at the event. Durham says she's worried that if the oil industry starts drilling in the Arctic Refuge, that land will be shut off to people who want to enjoy the wilderness. She's been there four times.
So everything in that area there is going to be tied up. It's going to be like private land. Nobody will be able to go there.
Durham came to the event with her longtime friend, Joan Galt. They met on a flight from Anchorage to Washington, D.C. more than a decade ago. They were going there to lobby against drilling in the Arctic Refuge. Galt is also deeply unhappy with the way things are going under Trump.
I feel depressed and anxious about how hard I'm going to have to fight over the next few years.
But unlike her friend, Galt does find one reason to be optimistic.
I do hope that we don't open the Arctic Refuge to drilling, that it actually gets started. But I kind of feel like maybe the oil companies aren't going to be that interested.
Galt believes there's no guarantee it will be economic for oil companies to drill in the refuge. And that, she says, is a reason for her to stay hopeful. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Alaska leaders want Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to push Canadian officials to better protect Southeast fisheries from British Columbia mine projects. The governor, lieutenant governor, and congressional delegation made their ask in a joint letter sent last week to the U.S. State Department. Lieutenant Governor Byron Malotte says officials want environmental protections discussed at an upcoming meeting of the department and its Canadian counterpart.
We focused on asking them to have the BC mining projects, the Transboundary Treaty, and the implementation of it as it relates to transboundary rivers in Alaska be included on their agenda.
State officials made similar requests to John Kerry, the previous Secretary of State, but his department sent the issue back to Alaska since it was already consulting with British Columbia. Since then, tribal, environmental, and fisheries groups have demanded stronger action to protect watersheds where Alaska salmon spawn and grow. Chris Zimmer works for Rivers Without Borders. The environmental group is warned of the dangers of transboundary mining for more than a decade.
This is what's been needed all along, is this concerted approach from our members of Congress and the state to the U.S. federal government. And then hopefully what that will result in is a concerted approach to BC and Canada both to deal with some current issues we have with transboundary mining.
Two mines and more than half a dozen exploration projects are active not far from the Alaska border. Another long-closed mine is leaking acidic water. British Columbia and U.S. State Department officials could not be immediately reached for comment. Mine owners and developers have said their projects don't pose a serious threat to Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what happens to trash in southeast Alaska? Much of it is barged south.
The landfill was reaching a level to where they really needed a new location. It was becoming a mountain.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Organizers anticipate some 200 participants will gather at University of Alaska Fairbanks this week for a three-day symposium on tribal governance. The event comes on the heels of a decision by Alaska's Attorney General in October recognizing tribal sovereignty. KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
Kerry Stevens is University of Alaska Fairbanks Assistant Professor of Tribal Management and one of the organizers of this week's Tribal Governance Symposium. She says recent events will undoubtedly occupy much of the discussion at the symposium. In October, during the Alaska Federation of Natives Conference, Alaska Attorney General Jana Lindemuth issued a ruling that recognized the sovereignty of Alaska's 229 tribes. Stevens says sovereignty includes greater self-determination as well as forging enduring relations.
Building stronger, better partnerships between tribal governments and Alaska Native corporations will be a big part of the dialogue, and we see a huge momentum in that work of building those bridges for the future.
Stevens also praises the First Alaskan Institute, which is co-sponsoring the symposium. She says the organization is doing groundbreaking work in racial equity. She says the symposium blends Native cultural values with the more academic structure. For example, Stephen says each panel discussion will include an elder.
And as elders share their stories, it puts all of the learning into a context that Alaska Natives from all over the state can then equate to their daily lives and put into practice.
Stephen says the symposium's title, Land, Water, Life, underscores the holistic approach towards management Native culture exhibits. For Brooke Wright, that's almost literally the case. The young mother of five grew up in Rampart. She says her family depended on subsistence practices, and she entered the tribal management program to learn advocacy skills to ensure that continues. She now serves on the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission.
I started out as a commissioner, and at the last meeting, I was actually selected to be the chair, and I don't think I would have taken those positions had I not attended tribal management.
Wright says the program also spurred her to continue her education. She's now enrolled in UAF's undergraduate program in fisheries. The Symposium on Tribal Governance continues through Wednesday at noon at UAF. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
When you toss a candy wrapper in the trash, you're sending it on a 1,000-mile journey to the lower 48 landfills. That's the case if you live in one of five southeast Alaska communities that send their garbage south via barge, truck, and train. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld, KNKX's Ed Ronco, and the Northwest News Network's Tom Bonzi take us on a trip beginning in Sitka. The report is part of the Coast Alaska News series, Talkin' Trash.
Sitkan Megan Pasternak stands in her kitchen, holding a bag of garbage. So, tell me, what's in your trash?
Not much. There's a couple used paper towels, I hate to admit, and some stuff that could be composted because it's vegetable stuff, but we aren't doing that anymore because of the bears around here, and some plastics that I couldn't recycle, and a few odds and ends.
Do you ever think about what happens to it?
Not really, but I always like garbage day because it goes away from my house and just disappears.
Of course, it doesn't. A garbage truck picks up her trash can, dumps the contents inside, and hauls it to a solid waste transfer station across town. There, it and most other Sitka trash is unloaded, shoved into shipping containers, and trucked back across town to a barge dock. It joins more containers from Sitka and other southeast towns. Sitka's trash has taken that trip since the year 2000, when officials realized they were running out of space.
The landfill was reaching a level to where they really needed a new location. It was becoming a mountain.
Former Sitka City Administrator Hugh Bevan says officials considered building a new dump, but more stringent environmental regulations would have made it extremely expensive. New landfills have to virtually eliminate polluted runoff, and that's hard to do in Southeast, where it rains up to 12 feet a year.
And the idea of shipping waste to an off-island landfill rose to the top as being the most cost-effective over the long term.
Sitka now barges approximately 8,000 tons of garbage a year, around 800 miles to the south. There, it begins the next step of the journey.
I'm Ed Ronco in Seattle. Just about 10 days after they leave Sitka, the barges full of trash make their way to the Puget Sound region here in Washington. Alaska Marine Lines carries garbage from communities with as few as 400 people and as many as 14,000. From there, a truck is going to take these containers full of trash to the place I'm standing right now. This is the Republic Services Yard. It's just south of downtown Seattle. Each year, this place moves nearly 22,000 tons of trash from Southeast Alaska. And from here, the containers full of trash, they go onto rail cars, and then they're off, traveling about 300 miles east, and that is where we're heading next.
I'm Tom Bonsi at the Roosevelt Regional Landfill in South Central Washington. This is where the long journey of Southeast Alaska's trash comes to an end. We're in a wide bowl a few miles above the Columbia River. It's bone dry, and there's not a neighbor in sight, which are two key reasons why this landfill is here and why it's been so successful in getting contracts with cities near and far.
It's under the radar, and really that's the way we like it.
Don Tibbetts is a Washington State-based manager for Republic Services, which owns this landfill. Tibbetts says the regional landfill business took off when the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency cracked down on the nasty runoff from garbage dumps. Tibbetts says this landfill is highly engineered with liners and collection systems to capture and treat whatever harmful liquid does percolate through. As you heard Ed Ronco explain, Southeast Alaska's garbage leaves Seattle for here by train, along with much of Western Washington's trash. The arriving trains often stretch more than a mile long.
So more than likely, about 10% of the containers that you see on the train in front of you has Alaska waste on it.
One last truck ride shuttles the garbage containers a short distance uphill to the landfill, where the trash is finally tipped out, compacted, and buried. And now we head back to Ed Schoenfeld in Southeast Alaska, where this all began.
Before this region's communities started shipping garbage to the lower 48, they considered a similar option not so far away. The Southeast Alaska Regional Solid Waste Authority looked at a chunk of land in Thorne Bay on Prince of Wales Island's eastern shore. City Administrator Wayne Benner heads up the authority's board.
When they first started up, they were looking at a regional landfill facility, but then after the study was done to look at it, it just did not pencil out.
So Petersburg, Wrangell, and Kluwak joined Sitka and Ketchikan by hiring Republic Services to haul their garbage south. Benner says Thorne Bay will be next. Not every Southeast community ships out its trash. Juneau, with about half of the region's population, still uses a local landfill. So does Haines. I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
More food trucks, retail, parking, and an expanded USS Juneau Memorial are in the works for Juneau's downtown waterfront. Last week, the city released a design plan to develop the area from Marine Park to Taku Smokeries. Gary Gillette, port engineer for Juneau Docks and Harbors, says the aim is to create a space both for visitors and locals.
Our waterfront that we've been building up with the new cruise berths and stuff has been primarily focused towards serving the cruise industry. But we really hope that something will spark locals to get it encouraged to come to the area in the off season, which in turn would spark some of those business owners to stay open in the winter.
A large portion of the area for development is owned by Morris Communications, a Georgia-based media company. They previously owned the Juneau Empire. Gillette says the plan is to work with a company to develop the area.
We've been working with the private owner, to make sure that they get what they need and we get what we need, and that it all works together. So when it's all done, it'll be one logical, cohesive plan and cohesive area.
The Docks and Harbors Board is scheduled to vote on the design plan November 30th in Assembly Chambers at Juneau City Hall. Gillette says they hope to have the first phase developed in 2019. Other portions will follow as funds allow.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The Alaska Board of Game wrapped up its recent meeting in Anchorage after voting on some changes to statewide hunting regulations. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports.
The board heard roughly 70 proposals, and only a little over a dozen passed. The board voted to ban the use of air bows for hunting big game in Alaska. Using compressed gas, air bows fire an arrow with enough power to take down game as large as a bison. In another example of keeping up with advances in hunting technology, the board decided to update rules around the use of electronic devices in hunting, things like game cameras that can now transmit real-time images to cell phones. The board voted to prohibit the use of wireless communication in the taking of a specific animal until after 3 a.m. the day following the use of the device, in most cases. The board also removed a restriction it put into place in 2012 that limited applications for bull moose permit hunts to three, agreeing with the Department of Fish and Game that the restriction had come with the unintended consequence of voiding some applications. And a follow-up to a story last week on a proposal to allow Alaskans to own small hedgehog-like creatures called tenreks, the board did not approve tenreks as pets, and they will remain prohibited in Alaska. A complete list of the game board's decisions, including more details on the preliminary regulation changes, can be found online by following the links at the Department of Fish and Game's website, adfg.alaska.gov. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Four military veterans are riding motorcycles from Alaska to Argentina. Riding the Pan America route is not unusual, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Army vets are attempting an unprecedented continuous journey that includes going through the roadless Darien Gap.
The Where the Road Ends expedition started in Dead Horse on Veterans Day. Expedition leader Wayne Mitchell, who grew up in Alaska, says the idea for the 19,000-mile Pan-America journey began with a conversation with fellow rider and Alaskan Mike Eastham when they were deployed overseas.
In 2004, Mike and I were in Iraq together, and we were talking about how they still hadn't built a road from Panama to Colombia.
Mitchell says the 100-mile stretch of swampy jungle known as the Darien Gap has been traversed a couple of times by motorcyclists making the trip from Alaska to Argentina, but not as part of one continuous journey.
The reason why nobody's really done it in a continuous trip is because to travel by land through the Darien jungle, you have to shoot for January, February, when it's the dry season. So in order to do that, when you kind of backward plan from there, you're left with going through Alaska in November.
It was a good shakedown cruise, for sure.
Expedition member Simon Edwards recounts the trip south from Prudhoe Bay as fairly smooth. He says except for sliding off the road a couple of times, the riders and their sidecar-equipped motorcycles held up well. Whether it's the cold and darkness of Alaska or the heat and snakes of Central America, Edwards says Army training has prepared the team.
In the military, you get real comfortable with being uncomfortable.
We're used to frustration, and we're also used to improvising and depending upon ourselves to get through a challenge.
Team member Rich Doring of Fairbanks hosted the expedition at his home, characteristic of Alaskan hospitality. Rider and mechanic Mike Eastham expects won't be matched as they head south.
The Alaska portion has been gravy because of the support. Quite honestly, you know, a place to stay and meals, and that will be the easiest part of our trip. I'm not joking. When we hit Canada, it's tent camping and hot dogs and oatmeal, you know.
The team cites numerous people and businesses that are backing the trip, which is being filmed for a documentary. Expedition leader Wayne Mitchell says it's about shining positive light on military veterans' post-combat lives.
As the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have continued on, a lot of veterans are getting out of the service and doing a lot of really cool things. And I don't think they don't really get advertised as much, and they don't get talked about as much in the media. So that's certainly one of the goals of the documentary side of it.
The Where the Road Ends expedition is scheduled to reach the southern tip of South America this coming March. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The World Ice Art Championships will not happen in 2018. Ice Alaska, the Fairbanks nonprofit which has organized the annual March event since 1989, released a statement over the weekend saying the 2018 championships have been canceled. Ice Alaska's main building burned last December, and the 2017 event was held using an alternate building and tents. The release says the 2017 championships were not up to the standards of artists or volunteers. It says reorganizing and rebuilding occurred over the summer, but the recent loss of two major donors and diminished support from its title sponsor resulted in the board's decision to cancel for 2018. The release does not mention BP. The oil company has long been the World Ice Art Championships title sponsor. Ice Alaska's organizers say they'll work toward the 2019 championships by seeking new sponsors and investigating alternate venues. 2018 event supporters are being offered a refund of their contributions. That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ed Schoenfeld, and Julia Caulfield in Juneau, Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco and Tom Bonzi in Washington State, and Elizabeth Harbaugh and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by...
Support for Alaska Public Media comes from GCI, with complete technology solutions for organizations that keep Alaska's communities and economy thriving. GCI is your partner in possibilities. Now through December 15th is the open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska. Plan costs have gone down this year. For free help to enroll, visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust. Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.